It is a it's a real pleasure for us here at the Kollel to be able to welcome Michael Eisenberg. It is his first time speaking at the Kollel, although I think he has connections to several of the Madrichim and many of the guys who have been in the program. And certainly many of the Madrichim have had the opportunity to hear him speak and to learn his Torah and to be able to get exposure to him and all that he does. We're speaking tonight largely with the topic of Godless HaAdam, of striving for excellence and striving for greatness. We have the exposure, or we have the opportunity, day in, day out, to be in a Beis Medrash with people, with Rosh Yeshiva, who model for us a particular kind of excellence, a particular kind of success. And what I think is very exciting about the opportunity to be able to host tonight is to hear from someone whose success, to hear from someone who strives and lives a very ambitious life in the world of finance, in the world of business, or venture capitalism specifically, and also at the same time, a person that has published some wonderful svarim. I think by my count, we're at five. Is that accurate? Five. Wonderful svarim on Chumash, on Yerushalmi, on Megillas Esther. And really a great opportunity for us to be able to get a degree of exposure to what things look like outside of the world of the Beis Medrash, but really, really beyond. I'm going to be asking a couple of questions just to sort of like facilitate the discussion. It is very much not my show at all, but just to, I guess, begin the discussion a bit. I guess the first would be just a little bit of background as far as where you're from, and in particular, as far as your role in the business world nowadays.
Can I stand up?
Yeah, please, sir.
All right. Now I can see everyone.
You want
this. All right. Good evening, everyone. Thanks for having me. Thank you, Rabbi Toretsky. I kind of wish that this Kollel existed when I was a teenager. I ended up spending two summers in Camp Stechem, and I wasn't much of a camp guy as the time went on. But halavai that there would have been Limud HaTorah in the summer when I was a kid. Let me help you out. There wasn't. And some of you are up here, Rabbi Kamenetsky and I spent summers at other places. But this is an unbelievable opportunity to come learn and make friends for life, so you should cherish it. As you hear from my accent, I did not grow up in Israel, but I have been living here 28 years. I grew up in New York, on the west side of Manhattan. Family have been there for a very long time. And I had a transformational experience when I was here in Yeshiva. So I went to YU for a year. And then after my first year in YU, which at the time, I don't know if you can still do it, it was like my senior year of high school at MTA, went a year early to YU. And then after the first year, I came to the Gush. And for those of you who are here this year and experienced some of the rocket fire from Gaza, this notion of running to a safe room happened during that year as well. It was the first Gulf War in 1991. It was actually my Shana Bet in the Gush. And after Purim, the war ended on Purim, and after Purim, I found myself in a room with Rav Yehuda Amital, Zichrono Livracha, and we're 15 guys. And I asked Rav Amital like a yeshiva bacher question. I said to him, Harav, used to say Rebbe in America, but maybe it was Harav, is there a bigger mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael for somebody who comes to live in an unpopulated place, or if you move to Yerushalayim and Tel Aviv, populated places, it's the same mitzvah? And he looked at me and he said, Zakos Shniyot. It's all nonsense. Make aliyah, set up a factory that will employ 10,000 people who can earn an honest and decent living. That would be the biggest mitzvah of settling the land of all. And I sat there, I remember he was like sitting over here, I was over here, kind of stunned. It was the first time I had heard a rabbi talk about economics and jobs, and earning an honest and decent living. Without being mezalzel, the rabbeim I had in high school didn't know this language. I still find, excuse me, most rabbeim don't understand this language. Hope nobody don't take offense. And it grabbed me. And I basically on the spot decided I'd make Aliyah and try to set up a factory that'll employ 10,000 people to earn honest and decent living. It took me two more years to go back to YU. Then I graduated YU at the end of May, got married on June 13th, and made Aliyah on August 11th, 1993. Spent a year and a half in political consulting, and basically for the last 25 years, I've been in the venture capital business. Anyone know what the venture capital business is? Go ahead.
People come to you with those ideas and you're investing them?
Yeah, not just business ideas. Anyone have, you said people come to me with business ideas and I invest in them. Anyone have a more specific definition?
Small businesses.
Small businesses is true. They're actually not even yet businesses.
Entrepreneurs,
but a certain kind.
Products,
certain kind. Startups, high-tech startups. So I've been investing in high-tech startups since roughly 1995 at venture capital funds of one form or another. And was really fortunate, blessed, that when I got started here in 94, 95, it was the beginning of the high-tech industry in Israel. It was the early innings of the high-tech industry in Silicon Valley, which started in the late 60s, early 70s. But it was also the advent of this miracle called the Internet. You all grew up on the Internet. I didn't. But the Internet was the miracle of the mid-90s. And it transformed the world. And I was fortunate, blessed, that when I was in YU, you can't even believe this, I had a little exposure to this thing called the Internet before it was called the Internet. It's a long story in and of itself, but I'll spend time on it. And I spent the last 25 years being blessed to work with some of the smartest people in the world who are here in Israel, whose goal is to transform the world through innovation, products, startups. And that's been just a tremendous blessing, a tremendous bracha. And that's what I do in my day-to-day life.
Have you, as someone that invests in a lot of different companies, have you had any failures along the way? And how did that impact, I guess, you and your trajectory?
So venture capital math is like a batting average. So venture capital is a little bit like baseball in that, but not like Moneyball. Like the way they used to do five-tool players and stuff like that. So it's a grand slam home run business. What does that mean? You could have a guy get up and strike out a lot. In my time, Reggie Jackson. Today, Giancarlo Stanton, one of those other guys. But if you hit a grand slam home run, it makes up for a lot of mistakes. And so my batting average is actually not that great for an investment business. If you're investing in the stock market, in the public markets, you got to be right a lot more than you're wrong. I don't need to be right a lot more than I'm wrong. In fact, I lose my money on about 50% of my investments. But the ones that hit need to hit big. And Baruch Hashem, a few of them have hit big. And they make up for a lot of really silly mistakes. But I think the important point around this is, boy, how do I say this so most people walk through life avoiding risks, right? Just think about evolution. Think about, we walk around, we try to avoid the angry dog. We want to avoid the pothole. We walk through life trying to avoid risk. My job is actually to embrace risk, because you don't get grand slam home runs unless you swing for the fences. You're not going to get any grand slam home runs and take a big, hard swing. Now, if things are obvious, if technologies are obvious, entrepreneurs are obvious, then it's priced in, and I'll come back to this in a second. It's priced into the price you pay. And everyone would invest there, so there'll be a lot of competition. And my job is to actually embrace risk, and even more so to embrace uncertainty. Embrace uncertainty. In my next volume of the book series, on Bamidbar, I've written already on Bereishis Shemos and Vayikra and Chumash, on Bamidbar, I think one of the lessons of the Midbar, we now just finished Matos Maaseh, is actually God telling the Jewish people to embrace uncertainty. If you read through the Pesukim in Bamidbar very carefully, you'll observe that Hashem, God, is actually in uncertainty. We can prove it. Who wants to prove it to me from Pusik, not from Bamidbar, from Shmos? And Mamar Har Sinai, what does it tell us about Moshe Rabbeinu? Moshe Nigash El Arafel Asher Shama Elohim. What's the Arafel? It's the fog. He doesn't have any idea what's going to be there. There's a famous Medrash that Moshe stood on a cloud. It wasn't Moshe stood on a cloud. There was no firm footing underneath it. He could fall. God lives in uncertainty. And upside in investing lives in uncertainty. I have a partner, Bruce Dunleavy, at Benchmark, who used to say, the venture capital business is like this. If this goes right, and 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 this goes right, you've got a really big outcome. The odds of each of those going right is about 5%. When you multiply 5% times 5% times 5% times 5%, what kind of number do you get to? A really small number. So the odds are actually really small, but if it happens, boom, it creates a big deal. And so that's what I get paid to embrace, is uncertainty, to invest in really ambitious entrepreneurs who want to change things. I got news for you. The entrepreneurs who start startup companies, and that includes Larry Page and Sergey Brin and Google and Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook and Elon Musk and Tesla, not one of them started those businesses to make money. I got news for you. There are easier ways to make money than to be a tech entrepreneur. They started because they saw something was wrong, wanted to change it, wanted to fix it.
In speaking about, I guess, striving for excellence from a religious perspective, most of the speakers that we will all be hearing from tonight primarily function or almost exclusively function within the Orthodox community. That's who they're working in yeshivas, working in Jewish day schools. As someone that's, I guess, more out there in a certain sense and interacting with a wider range of people, what opportunities are there from like a religious perspective interacting with non-Frum Jews, non-Jews, in different contexts and different forums?
All right. So the first thing I'll tell you is I actually know very little about striving for excellence. My mother used to say at the Friday night table that she davened and she prayed for kids who would be mediocre. It's not a joke, by the way. This is true. For years it really bothered me, actually, that why did my mother daven for mediocre children? At the age of 40-something, I don't remember what it was, I called her and I said, Mom, you were right. She used to say that the line between brilliant, excellent, genius, and crazy and nuts was really thin. So she wanted mediocre children. And there's actually a deep insight in that, by the way. There's a really deep insight in that. I called her and said she was correct. And then, by the way, I got interviewed for an article in a newspaper, and they said, tell me the most kind of counterintuitive piece of advice you ever got. And I said, I don't know about counterintuitive piece of advice, but my mother prayed for mediocre children. And there's a real insight in that, and that is sometimes other people put expectations on us that are tough to live up to, and they mess with our brain. And they mess with our attitude. But my mother, I think, was actually a parental genius in this. And I owe her a tremendous debt of gratitude. I think we all my siblings and I do. And that, don't be nuts. And you'll strive, and you'll find. But my expectation is that you should be good, not great. And don't fall over. So please, God, you'll all be parents soon. Think hard about that. My mother is actually a genius. I'm going to change your question around because I think there's a notion out there that somehow people we call Orthodox Jews need to have hashpa on others and bring them in. I got news for you. There's a large Jewish people out there. It's actually a tiny Jewish people in reality. And we have what to learn from every one of them. And we could use, a little more humility in our own interactions with them. That'll bring people closer, not farther. At the same time, I find that when you're out in the business world, and I'll tell a couple of stories, people respect people who are true to themselves, who are not judgmental of other people, but are true to themselves. So one of my earliest experiences, I was at a conference in Scottsdale, Arizona, and it's this invitation-only conference that I weaseled the ticket to. And we're at dinner, and there's 300 people there, and I put down that I wanted a kosher meal. And like, it's always embarrassing at this thing, they come out with this giant plate with a dome on it and tinfoil wrapped around it like this. And I start peeling off the tinfoil, I'm sure I'm going to find like the driest steak ever at the bottom of it. And peel off the tinfoil. And I got this ball of tinfoil. You're laughing at hitting on me, right? And like the whole table, and there were some Jewish people at the table and some not Jewish people at the table, is like looking at me at the spectacle of taking off the tinfoil. And like nobody's eating, they're all kind of looking like this. Everyone's all uncomfortable. I finished eating my tinfoil, I got this ball in my hand. And I said, boy, it takes a lot of self-confidence to eat kosher in public. And it's like dead silent at the table, and puts her head down and goes back to it. But somebody came over to me afterwards and said, hey, that was pretty cool. And I think it was. Another bizarre story. It's really strange. I don't work on Chol HaMoed. I always say, in Chutz Laaretz, nobody works on Shabbos and Yom Tov. Everyone works on Chol HaMoed and Tisha B'Av. So I made Aliyah in order not to work on Chol HaMoed and Tisha B'Av. I didn't know anyone growing up who didn't work on Chol HaMoed and Tisha B'Av. Maybe it's changed. I doubt it, because a lot of my friends go on vacation. Well, Hanukkah time or winter vacation, but they work on Chol HaMoed. So I made Aliyah not to work on Chol HaMoed and Tisha B'Av. Hopefully we won't have Tisha B'Av, but we might. And I accidentally agreed to speak at a conference, also in Arizona, on what turned out to be Chol HaMoed. I got the calendar wrong. And it was the early 2000s, and buses were blowing up in Jerusalem. And they called from the conference to see if I was coming because of the terror events. And I then looked at the calendar and go, oh no, it's Chol HaMoed. So I called a posek, who I consult with, and I said to him, hey, I don't work on Chol HaMoed. I made a mistake. And I booked this thing. They called to ask if I was coming. I have a chance to get out of it now. But here's why they called, because of the terrorist buses. And he says, you need to go. He said, no one should be motzi laws in Eretz Yisrael that buses are blowing up. Life doesn't continue. So I went. And so I'm a little panicked like this. So I didn't eat anything but a shahakal the whole way there, because I was so angry at myself that I accepted to be out of my sukkah on it. So I flew all the way to Arizona, not eating, and it was before like 9/11, so I took a lulav and esrog. Somebody gave me a wood case for my lulav. And so I take this balsa wood case that he gave me, and I go to Scottsdale. And I called the kosher place there, Cactus Kosher, I don't know if it's still around. They left me a brown bag because they were closing outside. Picked up my food, and someone took a Chabad at a sukkah in a strip mall. This story is wild, by the way. And anyway, I find this thing, it looks like a sukkah, it's dark out. It's totally pitch black. I sit in there, I eat my sandwich. I hadn't eaten for almost 20 hours. Anything real other than a shackle. And all of a sudden, like, there's a rustling. I go, oh my God, it's going to be here. And two guys peek into the sukkah. One with suspenders, and says, who are you? And I said, my name is Michael. Is it okay if I use this sukkah? I'm not going to lie, I was like a little nervous. And I'm not a nervous guy. And he said, where are you from? I said, Jerusalem. David, there's a guy here from Jerusalem. Come on in. And these two guys sit down with me for like 2 hours in the sukkah. All I want to do is get to my conference in Scottsdale. And the next morning I wake up and I drive to Phoenix to go to shul. And I come back from shul into the parking lot of the Princess Hotel. That's how vividly I remember the story. And there's a guy I know from the conferences, who I didn't know was Jewish, by the way. But I see him at a couple of conferences, who sees me carrying on my balsa wood lulav case. He says, what's that? I go, oh man, how am I going to explain this? But I decided, true to yourself. So I said, it's a religious object called a lulav. And he says, a lulav? A lulav? I said, yes. He says, I haven't shaken one of those since my bar mitzvah. And literally, there in the parking lot of the Princess Hotel, I shook a lulav with this guy. I met at a few conferences. But then, I could have lied. Right? I wouldn't know what to do. I could have said, oh man, it's just a pool. You know, pool cue case. But I keep finding that the truer we are to ourselves, the more you make contact with people. And so everyone needs a hug. Everyone needs to be treated with respect. And everyone expects you to be true to yourself. And I used to laugh. I'd drive down the street sometimes. You'd see people, you know, duck into the phone booth, Sadaf and Menfa. Come on, man. It's okay. It'll be okay. I don't know if that's what you wanted to hear, but...
So, something that's always struck me about you in a very impressive way is the ability to be very much involved in the world of finance and still somehow find time to, I guess, carve out some time to be engaged in high-level, rigorous Talmud Torah. Do you have any practical tips or advice for people that are, let's say, this year going to be in school and potentially, you know, very busy, balancing the dual curriculum, as far as any other piece of advice for those that want to try to succeed and excel in different areas, and in particular balancing sort of like the secular world, let's say for them with their classes, and trying to carve out time for real learning?
All right, I'm going to tell you something that nobody else will tell you because it's considered anathema in the modern world. You ready? There is no such thing as work-life balance. There is no such thing as balance. Balance is a false promise to a weak generation. It really is. Life is always out of balance. And anyone who tells you to search for it, yes, I know the Rambam. Okay, he's talking about midos, not life. It's false. And so you have to decide. I tell my kids all the time, you can only have one thing at the top of your priority list at any given point in time. One. There can't be three. Even two. One. At any given point in time, you can have one thing at the top of your priority list. Because time, think about it philosophically, is a point on a continuum. So if you're at a point in time, you can have one thing. And there's always pressures pulling you here and pulling you there. Always. Kids, wife, Torah, work, secular studies, parents, responsibilities to grandparents, rabbeim. There's always a pull. You need to decide what is most important to you now. And there are always, always, always pulls. And so I kind of decided, and I like the mornings. I don't do well at nights. I'm not focused enough. I get up early, naturally. I don't know why. It started when I was in Yeshiva in the Gush, when they still made davening at 6:30, now they've gotten to 7 somehow. And all these other yeshivas at 7:30 and 8, bowling. Mornings start early, and so I start learning in the mornings. And I find if you do it first, then it definitely happens. And trust me when I tell you, in real life, everything else feels like it takes precedence over learning. It really does. I get back to it. I'll open the safe. I'll learn later. I'll find time during Chazar Sashats. We're like that. So if you don't do it at the beginning of the day, it's really hard to be Koveya Itin. Now, sometimes if you have a Harusa, Rabbi Kamenetsky over there was my old Harusa's Harusa when they lived in Passaic, and everyone was kind of first married. They were super rigorous. They're bigger Masvidim than I ever was. And so he would come home from work, my friend Michael Selesny, he's a Chorna Lebracha, and they would learn. And night, I used to speak to Michael. I used to get up early in the morning. I'd call him. He had just gotten home from learning with Rabbi Kamenetsky there at 10:45 at night or something like that. I couldn't do that. That's the level of tzidkus that I can't do. And I think in the work world, it's tough. So doing it in the morning, I think, is a good idea.
You write in one of your sarim, which I think is as part of a comment on Yerushalmi, but in general, people often fight a lot surrounding money. There's a lot of competition, and because of the competition, people often have disagreements, and that, again, can wreak havoc on relationships and the like. Why do you think that happens, and does a different orientation towards money, would that lead to less competitiveness and more collaboration
Or is that just like part of it? Like when you're in the world of finance and it's a competitive scene, it's going to be competitive and there'll be disagreements.
So two things. One form of shameless self-promotion. My book on Voracious is actually up for pre-order on Amazon now. It's called The Tree of Life and Prosperity. And a lot of what I'll say now, well, not a lot, a lot of the topics that we cover, ethics, business, Torah, etc., from Voracious, is now available in English. So shameless self-promotion there. But I don't think there's anything about money. Look, the Gemara describes that the Talmidei Chachamim of Babel would basically kill each other based on Medrash arguing. The Yerushalmi describes in Shabbos that the Talmidei Beis Shammai were killing. They killed the Talmidei Beis Hillel not to let them up into the loft of Hananiah ben Garo. The story is told differently in the Babel. But Yerushalmi killed him. So arguments become passionate in every walk of life. It's true in Torah, it's true in business, it's true around money. There really is. We're a passionate species. And we can get super passionate about things. And I don't think... don't want you to get upset at me. I don't think there's anything different about human nature in money and Torah. Human nature is human nature. And in politics, for that matter, where it's worse. However, one needs to ask what they're arguing about. And if we debate and vigorously argue values, that's important. Money seems to have a tendency to get people's animalistic spirits out and running if you're not careful. So in the priority list, the values come before the money. And the issue before the transaction. And in life, life's a long game, please God. It's an iterative game. For those who know something about game theory, it's an iterative game. And so, nothing should be called a transaction. Everything should be called a brick in building a relationship. And that's really important. You'll fight about money less if you understand that it's a step, a brick, in building a relationship. What goes around comes around. I meet people in business now that I met 25, 27 years ago. Everyone comes around. And everyone remembers whether you transacted with them or treated them like a person in a relationship. Did you leave money on the table? It takes every last nickel off. Did you have to be right or did you listen? I have a partner, Alex Polkansky, used to say, God gave us 2 ears and 1 mouth, twice as much listening as talking. And that's part of the relationship building. That's part of not being transactional. And so, everything is a tool at the end of the day. Not in a Christian sense. That's maybe a long conversation. Not in a Christian sense. Not in a Christian sense, but in an ethical sense. That you have an opportunity to use an object, by the way, money, lavdil Torah, to have a relationship with another human being, with their soul, to build trust. You ever notice that the word emunah is the same shoresh as the word emun? Emunah, belief. Emun, trust. It's the same shoresh. Because if I have trust, I believe in you. And so, our whole life is about building trust. In my last book on Vayikra, I coined this term called kakalat achva, which is the economics of brotherhood. That's a sense. What the Torah is asking us to do is create rituals, in many ways, around an economic of brotherhood. Let me ask you a question. Why were people Ola Regel to Yerushalayim? Do you ever ask yourself that? Why 3 times a year go to Yerushalayim? Why does God say, come see me 3 times a year? Do you ever ask yourself? Why did he come to Israel Fiante? Anyone? You have no idea.
Holy country.
What's that?
It's a holy place.
It's a holy place. Why is it holy?
Because that's what our fathers used to do in Ireland.
That's what our fathers used to do. But I'm going to come back every year because I come once a year. Why I come 3 times a year? What are we supposed to do there?
Why do you daven every morning?
Why do you daven every morning is a good question, by the way. We're not going to talk about that here now because it's very different than coming to the Beis HaMikdash. But the Torah doesn't say that they came to the Beis HaMikdash to daven when they came to Olah Regel.
To build a connection with the land, because when you swing it three times, it becomes more like set in stone in you.
There's some destiny, some truth that why a connection to the land? Why am I coming? What am I doing there? The Torah tells us, by the way, it's a pasuk mefurish. Anyone? It's multiple pasukim, actually. I said, you're all kind of learning. Why do we go? Why? It's a pasuk. This is not like a medrash, a rashi, a ramban. Why? You're right, we bring karbanos, but why? What?
It's a relationship with God. It's
a relationship with God. Where'd you get that from? It doesn't say that, actually. That's not what it says in the Torah. Where did you get that from? But that's not what that pasuk means. He said we abandon our business to show faith in God. What does it mean? Go back a pasuk. It's to thank God? Where does it say that? That doesn't mean to thank God. What does that mean? Yeah, because it says u'smachtem lifnei Hashem elokechem, right? Who? The purpose of Aliyah LeRegel is to be makriv a korban shlomim. You also bring in olas re'ia. That's what the korban shlomim is to be shared. It's the biggest social network ever. Everyone comes to Yerushalayim to meet other Jewish people and share the bounty. Kivirkas Hashem Elokecha. It's a sharing festival. Lavdil, it's like Thanksgiving dinner, but you invited all of Klal Yisrael. And you share with them the bracha, the economic bracha you got. It says it, how many times in the Torah does it say? 8 or 9. It's like a lot. And by the way, the one time it doesn't say it is which chag? Anyone know? Why does it say Shavuos?
Because it definitely says
that. Okay. Anybody else? There's one chag it doesn't say it about.
Pesach.
Why? Because we already have a korban we share on Pesach. It's called the korban Pesach. It's eaten by mitzvahs nefashos. We already have the sharing. We don't need it. That's the difference. By the way, it says it twice on Sukkot and once on Shavuos and no times on Pesach in Parshas Re'eh. It's not an accident. The Torah is trying to set us up for this relationship with other Jews, with other members of the tribe.
We have time for a minute or two for one more question. Some of my strongest memories here at Sokolel involve Rav Lichtenstein walking into our base medrash. I know that he was a Rebbe of yours. I guess, especially in the context of your life in finance and business, is there maybe one particular memory or encounter that was, I guess, especially meaningful with Rav Lichtenstein?
The first thing that should be said is that Rav Lichtenstein had a tremendous hashpah on my life. I never met a more ethical person in my whole life. I'll tell two stories because they're two sides of a barn. So the first story I tell in my book, in a couple places. I was 19, or 18, I don't remember. I had just gotten to the Gush, so I was there a few months. And in those days, you didn't have Napster or iTunes or anything. So you have to kind of take yourself back in history. There was these called double cassette recorders. So they're like cassette tapes that you had music on, and then you could put a blank tape in to copy it. And I went to ask Rav Aaron whether he thought that it was mutter to copy the tape. Think about it, it's copying music, copying pictures, copying all these things that you copy online today with the click of a button. It was a little harder then, but they had these machines that did it. And I asked him if it was mutter. And he said, you bought the tape? And I said, yes. And he said, well, if you made a kidney on it, they can't tell you what to do about it. Hey, you with me over there? This is Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, it's not me. So he says, if you bought the tape, they can't tell you what to do with it. You made a Kenyan, it's yours. You can copy the tape. But you're not going to get a medal for Kedoshim to you. And he was referring to the Ramban, Al HaTorah, says he shouldn't be a noble Rishus HaTorah. You shouldn't be a scoundrel with the permission of the Torah. So it's mutter. It's legal. I can do it. It's the law. I'm good. But you're a manufel. You're a scoundrel for having done it. And I tell that story to my kids every year in Parshas Kedoshim, that you really want to get a medal for Kedoshim to you. It's on a certain level more important than the law. Because life's in gray. That's one story. The other story I told the Rav Aaron Shloshim, I think it was the Shloshim in Yeshiva. So you can find that on YouTube. I was at his house multiple times when people collecting stuck and knocked on the door. And every time he gave them a check or cash or money. And, every time. And these are not like Rebbe's stores or anything like that. I was at his house when he had moved to Alon Shvut. He was already frail. And there's a knock on the door, and two cradle guys are at the door collecting money for himself. I got up and get the door. He was frail. He asked me what it is. I said, two guys collecting money. And he gets himself out of his chair. He walks to the front door. And he asked them, what are you doing for a living? I'm a kohel. Don't you think you need to learn a profession to support yourself? No, we're learning Torah. Tell us about our lifting, okay? He was like the Gadol HaDor. Not like, he was the Gadol HaDor. No, we're learning Torah. He says, but maybe you want to take some courses. Something so you can support yourself, not have to knock on doors. You're young. You're capable. No, we're learning Torah. Support the Shulchan Torah. And Rav Aaron spent a good 10 plus minutes trying to give them a Musa Shmuz on the importance of working and earning your own living, which he was very big on. Earning your own living. And he didn't get anywhere. But Ben Shemesh learned Torah. Our Ben Shemesh learned Torah. I said, I couldn't believe it. And he has the most unbelievable patience talking to them. He says, turned around, after what must have been a very frustrating 10 or 15 minutes, Mr. Shmuz, he said, Michael, there's a bill on the counter over there. Please bring it. I'll give it to them. And I gave it to him anyway. And I said, that's actually unbelievable godless nefesh. You knew we weren't listening for 10 minutes. He did what he had to do, but he still gave him the money.
Thank you very much, Michael Eisenberg, for joining us.